Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be discussing No Quarter November, or should it really be called White Knight November? So that is what we're going to be discussing today. By the way, if it looks weird for me, it's because I'm on a slightly different setup. I'm using a different computer than I'm normally doing. So I'm looking down because a laptop and all compared to my normal setup. But I will try to be professional and look at the camera because, you know, we try to be a little professional around here. But anyway, that's give or take the rundown. Maybe we'll dive into some other topics because we're going to dive into Doug Wilson's defense of Ali Stuckey and female leadership, you know, using the Deborah principle, which seems like a novel concept, but it's not entirely a novel concept. It might be novel in the way that Doug Wilson's doing it. But using Deborah as an example of, you know, to glorify female leadership in the church or for a nation, that's rife in the history of feminism in the church. So maybe I'll get into my thoughts on Deborah in a minute. But overall, shout out to Defiant Baptist for going through the cringe. So we didn't have to go through the cringe, but, you know, now we're still going to go through the cringe anyway. He's very good at making sure that cringe is worth going through. So that's going to be the rundown for tonight. Maybe we'll, again, after that, if we still have time, we'll discuss more of what's going on in Conservative Inc. with the civil war between America First and Israel First, because I think the mask came off today, at least completely, because now we're just very honest about what the agenda is. So you love to see that, but we kind of already knew what the agenda was. So that's a give or take of the rundown for tonight. So just a recap of the story. There's been a lot of stuff going on with Ali Stuckey and I guess controversies surrounding her. I did a video at raising questions a couple of weeks ago because, you know, I'm not overly dogmatic on the issue of female conferences for women, because I don't oppose women's spaces on principle. But, you know, when a woman wants to lecture men on men's issues, you know, I don't want to see that, and I don't want to listen to that for the same reason why I don't want to listen to women do play-by-play or color commentary on a sports game. So, you know, it's kind of the same thing.
Really,
it's not natural. It doesn't sound it. There's no way to really sound like an expert on it. And at best, you might sound a little bit too enthusiastic for a man's message, like a Pearl Davis. So,
well, I mean, really, no self-respecting man actually would listen to a woman about how to be a man.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a contradiction that any man she's trying to help. Well, the first step in helping yourself, so to speak, is to have some modicum of self-respect, which you're not going to have if you're listening to Ali Beth Stuckey talk about men's issues. And the other thing is she actually framed pornography as being bad because of how it affects women. It's kind of like porn bad, but women most affected, which is kind of a common feminist motif is like, oh, this thing is bad, but like women are most affected. You know, men are lonely. A bunch of men are single or whatever, but women are most affected. Like, it's kind of a feminist trope.
Yeah, you're right. Especially in modern days, it's the women who benefit the most from this industry. You look at the way that people are getting recruited into OF. It's being glorified and glamorized in popular culture that, hey, you turn 18, you're already a valuable commodity just because you can frame it as turning 18. So you're already valuable for that reason. You know, it's just legal. You know, you couldn't do it earlier because it wasn't legal. But once it's legal, it's completely legal, and you can leverage that to get a quick following and make a lot of money quickly. And yeah, the incentive structure is there, and women take advantage of that. And when it comes to Vice, I do believe that the supply side is more responsible than the demand side. I blame drug dealers and drug manufacturers more for the supply of drugs than the dope heads. So that's just basic logic. Like, which one would you charge more severely, the person who is selling or the person who is using? Obviously the person who is selling. So I think the same thing, the same principle applies to the issue of pornography. So anyway, man, we're talking about that very early in a stream. I don't know if YouTube still demonetizes stuff like that, but anyway, because they definitely have relaxed their monetization rules all over the place. So with that said, let's dive into the Doug Wilson response, because I hear it's a doozy. So here we go. I guess we'll go normal speed for now, see if that needs to change, but we're definitely not watching it at 480p. Let me get that update date. All right, here it goes.
And the transgressive things I'm talking about are not a negative view of Netanyahu, but rather things like lusting after your sister. In short, 2 tons of no bueno. It is worth mentioning at the outset that Barak was a great hero of the faith and not a timid man at all. He was no coward, and he won a great battle on behalf of the people of Israel. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, Hebrews 11:32-33, NKJV. When he refused to go to battle unless Deborah accompanied them, she did tell him that he would miss out on just one thing as a result. We will get to that one thing in a minute. Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was already a judge in Israel when the scene first opens, Judges 4:4-5. Moved by God, she summoned Barak and told him to go and fight against Sisera, and that if he did so, he would prevail, Judges 4:6-7. He replied that if she agreed to accompany them, he would do it. If not, then not, Judges 4:8. Deborah's reply, greatly misunderstood to this day, was that she would in fact go, but that as a result of the condition placed on it, he would miss out on a particular honor, the honor of killing Sisera himself, Judges 4:9. The Lord shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. This was a prophecy of Jael's intrepid action, when she fastened Sisera's head to the tent floor more securely than it had been before. The particular honor of killing Sisera himself was forfeited by Barak, true enough, but there's no indication he complained about it. However, then, in the great hall of faith, fame, in Hebrews 11, Deborah is not mentioned, and Jael's not mentioned either. But Barak is mentioned by name, who through faith subdued kingdoms. Deborah accompanied him to the river Kishon, but did not accompany him into the book of Hebrews. So it is long past time for us to be done sneering at Barak, who won a great battle and secured a place of honorable mention in the New Testament, unlike all the rest of us around here. At the same time, there's no hint that Deborah was out of line for exercising her prophetic gift or for judging Israel. So as we look at the history of the judges, we can glean an important principle about women in roles of civic leadership. That principle is that it is no sin for a woman to hold political office, provided it is as rare as a blue comet.
All right, so his limiting principle is a percentage, like a literal percentage. So I guess opening thoughts on that.
I mean, again, I do question the, I guess, the veracity of the claim that the participation of Deborah in the battle wasn't an act of cowardice on behalf of Barak. I would say that it probably was, just because he's mentioned in the Hebrews Hall of Fame, as it's called. I don't necessarily think that negates his underlying weaknesses. Like, we don't say that Samson, well, like, Samson's obviously mentioned, but again, we don't necessarily overlook his glaring weaknesses that are very well documented.
Yeah, I think that's a
just good because point. He did have a very strong finish. Same thing with Gideon. He started very well. He maybe ended very well, but there was a, like, after the victory, he basically becomes a king, is somewhat worshipped by the people, and he obviously multiplies his wives. So again, there's still a lot of, I guess, text to the story that he's overlooking to make a very cheap point.
So one thing that's true throughout history is that it is considered disgraceful for a man to bring his wife along into battle. Like, even Napoleon, when he brought Josephine into the campaign in Italy, it did not go over well. And then obviously, if you know the story of Napoleon, he doesn't bring his wife in the battle after that, or campaign after that. He brings other generals' wives into him throughout the thing. So he had a thing for sleeping with officer wives, which, very bad. But anyway, Or you can look at World War II would probably be the most most recent example of this. Reason why I think Erwin Rommel's extremely overrated is because on the day of D-Day, he wanted to take a vacation or whatever, a weekend trip to visit his wife, which was very ill-timed. And he should have known better than to do that because they knew the invasion was coming. They did not know where the invasion was coming, but he thought he could sneak in a trip, which, you know, very inopportune time. So it's considered very disgraceful to do stuff like that in ancient times and even through early modern and modern times. It's very poor judgment to do that. So there is a standard of military leaders that's being applied to Barrack, I think, by Deborah, by asking him to accompany him. Because you should not be bringing women into battle.
Again, we could also fast forward. The same concept would be in 2 Samuel with David and Bathsheba. David is supposed to be tending to his war, not staying back in the castle getting laid. Like, and same thing with Uriah, who does not get laid with his wife, instead sleeping on the footsteps of the palace. That's a high demonstration of honor and the notion of abstinence during war. That's a very important concept, especially in the ancient times. Obviously, you know, the Greeks might have had a little bit more deviance because they used sex slaves. But yeah, the Hebrew way was to abstain from sex during war. So I did pull up John Gill's commentary just to get a historic perspective, and yes, he does suggest that it was a weakness on part of Barrack to ask for Deborah's attendance to the battle, and it was in verse 8 he says it might be out of fear that other tribes would not believe him, and then in verse 9 it adds that she was perceiving some degree of weakness in him. So yes, it is a sign of weakness that he asked her participation.
Yeah, I mean,
so Doug was wrong probably on a historic, based on the historic commentaries.
It doesn't take away from the fact that Barrack had an otherwise pretty good military career. Let's just not take that away because, you know, obviously we're hyper-focused on one moment, a particular decisive battle and a moment of deliverance, but it's not like that was the only battle that he ever fought or only campaign that he ever went on. So, you know, when Hebrews mentions, you know, subduing nations as Doug Wilson just did, again, he probably had a prolific military career for the time. So, going back to Hebrews 11, these were all flawed individuals. And in fact, the Bible really does a solid for everyone to really highlight their flaws. You think of King David probably the most. Like, I feel like the Bible explores his flaws more than his virtues. If you just want to tally up King David's life.
I mean, it depends. If you weigh the Psalms, I would say the other way around.
Okay, yeah, taking out the Psalms, if we're just going narrative prose.
If you're looking at the back half of Samuel, 2 Samuel, then yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, you're reading and trying to, like, look at the history of the Old Testament and all. Yeah, it's...
But you also see the development. I mean, there is, you see how he responds to pressure and fear and anxiety in generally 1 Samuel when he's like on the run going and hiding with the Philistines. And then you kind of see how he reacts to, he's almost very resolved to accept his fate in 2 Samuel when he's on the run. So there is certainly a difference in how he responds to the fear and anxiety that surrounds him.
Right. So anyway, I guess we should get back to Mr. Doug as he, we still got like, 13 more minutes of this? Let's roll.
Having gotten that out of the way, we may proceed to discuss our actual problems here in the actual evangelical longhouse. As we discuss this, we are going to walk all the way around the boardwalk from the so-called heiresses of Deborah to Ali Beth's recent exhortation to the sexual dysfunction of Groiperism to Tucker and Fuentes, and then all the way back to the semi-respectable evangelical longhouse. That semi is important, for it is what makes all the hypocrisy possible. an inch and a mile. One is likely acquainted, of course, with the proverb that if you give a certain kind of person an inch, they are likely the kind of person who will then take a mile. You work your way through the book of Judges, evaluating the career of one male judge after another. You took note of Deborah, for she is certainly in there, registering the oddity of it to yourself. But knowing that all of Scripture is God-breathed, and that we should come to the Scriptures with an eagerness to apply what we read there, you consequently budget for the occasional Margaret Thatcher. Depending on how you count them, there are 12 to 15 judges of Israel, which would make Deborah's office about 8% of the total. So the lesson to be drawn is obviously that women in positions of civic leadership is not prohibited, provided that you maintain males in those positions at 90% or higher. That would be the level at which a society could safely be considered a patriarchal one. But I mentioned taking a mile. If you grant that Deborah was an actual judge, and she was not condemned for it, and neither was Lapidoth for that matter, and the first thing you know, the U.S. Senate has filled up with 57 Deborahs, something is radically askew. When you have 57 Deborahs, the realization slowly dawns on you that you have no Deborahs at all. If we had an actual Deborah, she, being a prophetess from God, would tell everyone to knock it off. She would say, in the words of one of our recent prophets, "Go home." As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err, and destroy the way of thy paths. Isaiah 3:12. So if you take a look around and discover that our body politic is festooned in feminists, girl bosses, take-charge fitness trainers, peroxided conservative commentators, inheritance senators, not to mention the cleavage bros, you realize that we have been had. It's kind of like celiac disease, a real thing and something that used to be something of a rare condition. But now, with restaurants falling all over themselves to rejigger their menus for everybody and their gluten-intolerant dog, one begins to suspect that we are dealing with something of a social contagion, a combination of celiac and boutique celiac. And in a similar way, we in the conservative Christian world are dealing with a social contagion of dinos, Deborahs in name only. Mom, Allie Beth's...
Alrighty, that's a good place to pause. What are your thoughts on the idea that it's only a Deborah if it's a special occasion versus, obviously, in modern politics in the United States, it's largely female-dominated. Let's just be real. You're cutting out. So...
I do kind of reject that a lot of these people are they're Deborahs. Again, it's the same thing with the Proverbs 31 women. Again, I see it on like the apps. I'm a Proverbs 31 woman. It's like, you're probably not. And again, the Proverbs 31 woman was not overweight, if we're just going to be really honest and blunt about it. But yeah, a lot of people like to assert that they're the exception when they're really just not. They're the aberration. And if we're going to be honest.
Or maybe they're just mid.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, they think they're the exception when they're not. And, you know. Like, is there really, I mean, again, you've raised the question of whether she is the next Beth Moore. I'm sure everyone and their mother was having this exact same debate over the rise of Beth Moore. Everyone and their mother was having the same debate over Amy Berg. Oh, she's not a Deborah. She's one of the good ones.
Or she is a Deborah. She's not one of the bad ones or whatever. Yeah. I think that's a good point. So what he's saying about female leadership, Deborah's really the only example in the Old Testament that's good. I know that the Catholics teach that, you know, the queen mother is the actual queen, which I don't really see any positive examples of that in the Old Testament. Like, there's a guy who was a rival to King Solomon who thought that he could ask Bathsheba if Solomon would grant him Abishag, who is the hot lady that they've recruited to be David's bed warmer. So I guess, but Solomon quickly saw to it that he wanted to marry Abishag in order to lay a claim to the throne and had him beheaded for that, even though he used Bathsheba to ask. And then obviously we have the Athaliah, I think it was
The one that possessed the castle and the throne while Josiah was in the temple, right? Or Joash.
Joash, yes. Yes, she was the queen who was not his mother, but I guess his stepmother who decided to stake her own claim to the throne.
Well, I guess the queen mother gets a higher honor simply because if the
king. But she wasn't the queen.
The king has multiple wives. I guess that's why the queen mother might get a little bit of a higher honor because.
Right. I'm just saying that Catholic teaching doesn't really hold water in the Old Testament, or at least not in any positive space. So the Bathsheba example is funny because the Catholics literally use that to justify praying to Mary. So I think that that example is kind of funny because, like, Jesus wouldn't dare say no to his mother. And that's kind of like the Catholic logic. But, you know, obviously the example in scripture, I mean, they would point to the wedding at Cana. But the example in the Old Testament of this, of, you know, Solomon being wise and gifted with discernment, sees through using his mother to manipulate him. So, and then pronounces judgment accordingly. So I'm trying to figure out, like, I'm trying to see, like, where it says how long Deborah was a judge for. It says that she was a prophet at and a judge at the time. And then the land had rest for 40 years. So I'm trying to see, is there somewhere in between that where it says how long she was a judge?
Well, even the notion of the judge, obviously the judge refers more to like a deliverer than like you're the chief magistrate. There might have been that.
It kind of goes both ways, though. Like the judge always starts out as a deliverer and then becomes like a de facto king.
Yeah.
Which is the case with Gideon, or, and even his son was named Abimelech, which means my father is king. So, you know, that's why you see that name often, because it means prince, basically. You name your son prince because his father is the king. So obviously there was a sense that the judges were de facto kings in the Old Testament, which, you know, if you want to extrapolate that further into 1 Samuel, maybe it's not a critique of monarchy in 1 Samuel. Just saying, just putting that out there. So I think it's problematic to suggest that Deborah as an exception to the rule. I don't know how you make that a carrying forward principle, because without devolving into feminism.
Well, I mean, even still, like the number, like he's trying to do the 1 in 12 or 1 in 15. But again, I don't even think that's accurate, because you got to include Moses, who was a judge and a priest. You have to
Joshua.
Yes, you have to include Joshua, who was the judge at that time. You then would have to include Samuel and Eli. And again, if you wanted to, you could include Samuel's sons, who were rejected by the people, which led about to Saul.
Right.
So, I mean, and again, we are adding to it.
And
I mean,
that's there was also a bit of an interregnum between Joshua and who was our first judge? Bethel? What was it? Anyway, first judge, because if you look at the ending of the story of Judges, Judges 19 onward, that takes place before the first judge. So the whole civil war thing, the whole Danites not taking their own territory and instead going north. Yeah, that happens before the judges come. So,
well, even still, then you have the other spheres of authority, which would, again, further dilute the claim that, you know, 1 in 15 or whatever that Doug Wilson's positing, because then you have the elders of the tribes.
So,
you know, and if you look throughout history, like Samuel Rutherford would refer to the elders as a parliament. Josephus would refer to them as a senate, because they're trying to communicate the Old Testament power structure into modern language. So they would equate it to functionally a republic.
Right. And again, can't remember which judge it was. Maybe it was also Gideon, the guy, because he might've had whichever judge had the sons that went around on donkeys and stuff like that. They were circuits. He went on a circuit. So the judges largely, when they were ruling, primarily functioned as a circuit court, which means, you know, you don't go directly to them. You appeal. It's an appellate court. You don't have the trial in front of the judge. You appeal to the judge. So that's largely what you see. Cause again, you read Judges, you're trying to understand how it actually worked.
Yeah, because the elders were still
there. One of the things about Judges is that I don't think every single conflict in Judges, every single cycle of oppression affected every single area of ancient Israel. So I think some of the conflicts were a little bit more localized. The other interesting thing about Judges is they have the numbers to fight back almost every single time and just don't, because they don't feel like fighting or don't think they can fight. You know, they're very lazy, except when it came to almost annihilating the Benjaminites, then everybody shows up. That's the one time everybody shows up and judges, and it's a civil war. But every other conflict, they don't really show up to fight. And, you know, that causes conflict between, like, the Ephraimites, who don't want to show up to fight or, you know, showed up late. That causes conflict when Gideon exercises reprisals on the people who did not provide bread to his army. So there's a lot of conflicts that arise in that period because, you know, people, you know, the tribes kind of largely focused on themselves. And they didn't really show up to fight for each other, which necessitated why judges were needed. So, and I also like to point out, like, how much actual judging was Samson doing? Like, I do wonder about that, you know? I know that he was a deliverer, but how much ruling was he actually doing?
He's judging the quality of the women.
In Philistine. Yeah. The Philistine women, not even like his own. So, anyway. Now we're going to get moving into the, I guess, the Stuckey part of this. Which, why do we call her Allie Beth Stuckey instead of just Allie Stuckey? Like, I'm not a fan of giving women three names.
Anyway. Bossing me. So here we all are in the feminist longhouse, wondering if there's a good way to navigate our way out of this leper colony. The longhouse rules dictate what the docile men are supposed to do, which they willingly do as their civic duty, abjuring their privilege as they go. Of course they do. But the rules are so entrenched that they also affect and drive the behavior of many of those who fancy themselves restive rebels against the matriarchy. But the feminists have done a much more thorough job smashing the patriarchy than the clickbait bros have done in smashing the longhouse. For example, Allie Beth Stuckey did a thing and gave a big sister talk to the men. Like most big sisters, she did not anticipate how it would come across and found that her pungent observations were underappreciated. She even had that big sister tone, which didn't help. There were howls of protest, many of them from men who found that they would rather talk about Allie Beth getting out of her lane than to even think about the men who have been enervated by porn. That would be to acknowledge that Big Sister might have had something of a point, and in many of the cases, she might have had a point about their own browser histories. But rather than think about their own browser histories, they concluded it would be much more edifying to yell about Allie Beth's conservative variant of feminism. And so yell they did.
So there he goes. The first thing that he's talking about is, it's Big Sister. You're not listening to Big Sister. She was correct, and you have a problem if you disagree with the premise of her lecturing men on men's issues.
I mean, let's start with Big Sister first. It is not brave or unique to confront pornography in the year 2025. It's not. Like, Matt Walsh has been doing this for years. John Doyle came out with his video, like, I think 2019, on his 2.5 to 3 hour dissertation on pornography, which has many of the stats that are now talking points today about the mental, I guess, the super stimulus effect of online porn. It has, like, all the data that we're using as talking points in combating the issue, except maybe an address of OnlyFans, because that hadn't quite peaked off yet. But yeah, I mean, if you go back in the history, or recent history, I should say, you'll see plenty of men confronting the porn issue. Like, she's not being brave. She's not being a big sister. And again, if you look at the response of certain women, like, especially if you include Riley Gaines into the conversation, who did the bikini calendar, trying to sexualize herself for a pinup.
And it's using not actually, you know,
and actual using actual have hoes. You know,
yes.
Like, actual hoes. Elon Musk, baby mama, that hoe, who worked for the Babylon Bee, by the way, using her.
Reposting Zam Mondani the other day.
Yeah, anyway. Using her. And no, they don't care about the porn issue. Like, they just wanted to use it as a cudgel against men. Oh, you must watch porn, so that means I don't have to listen or respect you. Like, that's what it's really about. It's just a cudgel. It's just a weapon. So, the Big Sister thing is...
Yeah, and it's an assumption.
It's an assumption.
Yes, and they're using the assumption as the cudgel, which, you know, our friend Defiant Baptist, I've seen, like, a lot of people accusing him because he spoke out against Allie's alleged feminism. I'm using alleged because, you know, his accusations more than mine in this case. But yeah, you bring up a good point. I want to highlight the fact that you say it's not brave to call it out in 2025. Yeah, that's 100% right. It's not brave. There was a time when it was brave. It's like, you know, being anti-lockdown in 2021. You're not brave. You know, it's like Ben Shapiro saying Anthony Fauci should be fired in December of 2020. You're not brave. Everyone on the right already had that opinion 6 months ago. But you think you're brave because you're saying it now.
Like, literally, states have already gone after from, like, you know, in implementing age restrictions. Like, that's been happening for several years now. You're not, again, it's not a new issue to confront.
Yeah. So we got to remember, you know, bravery is about taking the stand when it's not easy to take the stand. It's not easy for, it was easy for Ali Stuckey to take that stand.
It cost her nothing.
Like Riley Gaines, it was not brave. She's a victim, but she's not brave.
She's the David.
The time for courage, the time for courage was before Leah Thomas, the podium or whatever. That was the time for courage. Courage has a window of when it shuts. And
again, most of what Doug Wilson's saying is just bulverism. That's his classic go-to weapon. Oh, you disagree with me. That means you must have some browser history. No, it's like, no, my browser history is like pretty boring. No one could call it titillating in the slightest.
I have too many tabs. It might not be boring, but there's a lot of tabs. So many so that I need to use my laptop tonight because it has like way more RAM than my regular computer that I record videos on. So,
and again, it's just like, okay, I can provide my receipts on my browser history. Does that, like, what's your next argument?
Here's a trouble with, what if it's not browser history? And that's exactly right. Like, it's just another, like, that would technically fall under an ad hom fallacy.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's bulverism. You're assuming someone's motives. You're assuming they're wrong without actually explaining why they're wrong. You're just going to, you're a porn addict. You're a gooner.
Yes. So going back to our friend Doug Wilson, because, you know, there was a time when it was very friendly and cordial between the Christian nationalist camp and the Doug Wilson camp. But that time is not right now.
Bedrock of all that is rancid. Even for November, is this not getting out too far over my skis? Is this not a case of driving so fast at night that I outran my own headlights? On what basis do I make pronouncements about the browser histories of various unnamed Ali Beth critics, especially regarding the Anons, about whom I should know precious little? But if you think I know precious little, have you forgotten my connections to the Mossad? Didn't you watch the video? But seriously, even apart from any possible intel, the issue is simple. You all recall the metaphor of...
Can I just say that that joke does not land? And it's a delivery issue. Like, he's not sped up. Like, I normally speed people up to 1.25 or whatever. That's not sped up, but that's just a poor delivery of a joke.
No, even still, like, if you're trying to, like, convince people that are your detractors, make turning their objections into a joke like that. Oh, you know, I have your browser history. I have Palantir coming to me with your data files. Like, you're not actually taking their objection seriously.
Right. Anyway.
The tip of the iceberg, right? You can see 10% of the thing above the surface of the water, while the vast bulk of the thing is down below. There's a certain kind of behavior that we can see out there in the world, the tip of the iceberg that is visible, and Scripture describes it for us, describing the whole thing down to the icy bottom of it. And so here you go. For I fear, lest when I come, I shall not find you such as I would, and that I shall be found unto you such as ye would not, lest there be debates, envyings, wraths, strifes, backbitings, whisperings, swellings, tumults. And lest when I come again, my God will humble me among you, and that I shall bewail many which have sinned already, and have not repented of the uncleanness and fornication and lasciviousness which they have committed. 2 Corinthians 12:20-21. The public part, the part that you can see, is made up of debates, envyings, wraths, stripes, backbitings, whisperings, swellings, and tumults. In short, we are talking about all the misbehavior that is routinely on display in a contentious comment thread on X. I am not sure I've ever seen a better description of the nature of such comment threads. And so, in short, whenever such a display erupts, we are clearly talking about men who are less conversant with Deborah Judges Israel and more conversant with Debbie Does Dallas. We can say this because when Paul comes to Corinth and turns over the flat rock of backbiting, swellings, and tumults, he knows what he is going to find will be the worms and beetles of uncleanness, fornication, and lasciviousness. He knows that because he wrote it down in just the way he did. We know that too. Paul describes the smoke for us, and he also describes the fire. Tucker.
All right, that was an incredibly weak argument. Let's flip the tables back on Doug for a second.
Well, let me just say he actually just reiterated his prior bulverism by saying that, you see, it's the 10%, 90% below the surface. So therefore, because I call this the 10%, I'm saying that you're being causing strife, which again, I'm sure every reformer out there was accused of causing strife at some point.
Also, let's talk about Doug Wilson trying to go, a year-long campaign to cause strife for Joel Evans.
Yeah, Mr. Serrated Edge, Doug Wilson, who calls women "see you next Tuesdays" and did the middle finger Johnny Cash thing. Oh, I'm sure a lot of people would say, "Oh, I'm sure underneath the surface there's 90% sin and wrath and all that stuff in his heart."
Let's take it further. He's someone who married a PDF file to a woman, and then that PDF file relapsed in his, recidivism and stuff like that. He is someone who did that. Now, I'm not judging his decision. I'm just pointing it out that he did that.
Yeah, you could call
a lot of people could see that a lot of people, I'm not going to be those people, but a lot of people could call that the 10% that we see. And what is the 90% that we do not see?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
How about let's use that as an example of the 10% principle, Doug?
Yeah. This iceberg metaphor can be turned against you because you have a very treasured history and you've only been favorably received across broader conservative media for a couple of years now. You've only been getting the speaking tours on National Conservatism Conference for, I guess they've only been doing a couple of years. You've only been getting those Blaze interviews and those Daily Wire appearances for a couple years now. So, I get it. You're enjoying the time in the sun in your 70s. But for the most part, you were a pariah for decades. You were the slavery apologist. And I'm sure a lot of people accuse that of a 90% under the surface.
Yeah, the 90% under the surface is he has slaves in his basement, right? Anyway, but again, we could flip this around on him so easily.
And again, you would think he would have more grace.
Instead, he is raising things like, they were mean tweets. We're going back to mean tweets. Donald Trump, mean tweets. We're going back to mean tweets as our standard for saying this person has a deeply corrupt moral character.
You make mean tweets. That means you're a gooner.
Yes. And I get it. A lot of people do struggle in this area. The point is, first of all, I think they know it's wrong. There should be a little bit of shame, but at the same time, the systems are in place to incentivize women to create more of it. That is what exists. Men aren't necessarily incentivized to do it, but women are definitely incentivized to create it. And supply creates demand, especially with vice. So, if Allie wants to talk about this issue, she should really, and if she really wants to be useful on this issue, genuinely saying she should speak to women and rescue them from getting started in the industry. That's a tall ask in 2025. That's a lot braver than speaking to men on the issue, because again, men are already getting, a lot of men have been speaking to men on this issue for years now. It's not brave to do that. But how many women are speaking to women on this issue?
Yeah. How many women are actually willing to shame their peers for being sluts? Because again, women used to actually be decent at that.
I mean, no one's meaner to women than women, but at least in some respects, that nature can be used to, stigmatize immoral behavior. But that's not what's going on right now. Not at a societal level. All right, let's get through this. Tucker and Fuentes. Here we go.
And Fuentes. Fuentes. The conservative move is currently in an uproar over the fact that Tucker interviewed Nick Fuentes. There have, of course, been demands for performative denunciations, and there's been some compliance on that front, along with some interesting resistance. We've also seen some honest denunciations from those people who've always been opposed to the Fuentes brand of spite and malice, and not just because the left demands that they be opposed to it. There were also some objections, not to the fact of the interview, but rather to the fact that it was a softball interview. So all of that is going on. I am not going to denounce Tucker here, but I am going to warn him as a friend. If you reread the previous section, you will see and understand why I believe that there's no way for Fuentes to display openly and publicly the kind of demented attitudes towards sex and women the way that he does without having multiple black mold closets in his life, filled with the rotting debris of gangrenous lusts. The portrayals of gay porn that he has accidentally broadcast in the past provide just a glimpse of what is obviously going on. He has offered various explanations, of course, of the aliens kidnapped me, what year is it variety, and anybody who accepts such explanations at face value might be the very chumpiest of chumps. Nick Fuentes is bad news and one very lost puppy. When I was with Tucker, one...
So let's just say he's actually comparing people like Eric Kahn to Nick Fuentes.
I mean, again,
because Nick Fuentes didn't say anything about Ali Stuckey. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he was pretty silent on that. And again,
it wasn't Nick Fuentes going after Stuckey.
And obviously, yes. I mean, anytime we talk about Fuentes, like the gay question has always come up. But I do think Tucker was actually genuinely trying to help Nick Fuentes. And that's why the interview might be perceived as a softball. Like, I think he's trying to like mentor him to help him a little bit. But also,
as I would
like
to point out,
He used
Socratic method, and Ted Cruz crashed out at that. Nick Fuentes did not crash out. That's the difference.
But again, I mean, we don't know what actually happens in between and like out before and after the interview. We don't actually know what they're talking about. So again, there's a lot of other context we don't know about. Obviously, you know, yeah, Fuentes has some skeletons in the closet, and maybe was himself in the closet, but.
He's using an unrelated.
Yes, it is kind of non sequitur.
Yeah, it's a complete non sequitur unless you're calling everyone who's you're trying to lump everyone who's critiquing Ali Stuckey in with Nick Fuentes, which I think is completely irrelevant because it's two separate groups. And it's
again,
always been understood as two separate groups.
Ironically, his comments on women and marriage in the Tucker interview were actually generally positive and good for the most part. And obviously he has a bunch of clips out there, which one might say is taken out of context. I don't really know. I don't really care. But obviously he does play the role of court jester. So that kind of gives him almost like a license to make whatever outlandish statements he wants and just hide behind the cover of I'm just joking or I'm just being ironic. So I don't know what is or isn't serious with regards to any statements he gives. Because again, he could always turn around and say, I'm just joking.
Good question. Again, flip it back on Tucker or flip it back on Doug Wilson. Did Tucker give Doug Wilson hardball questions? Like, did he ask Doug Wilson about, you know, marrying a PDF file?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Tucker Carlson generally doesn't hardball someone. I mean, he might give a little bit of a sticking point for obviously Ted Cruz on the Israel thing, but. Again, how Ted Cruz reacted is different.
Yeah, Ted Cruz crashed out because he could not defend his arguments from scripture. And he was pressed to do so, but couldn't.
And again, part of the other reason on Tucker is he doesn't necessarily try to drive home to his audience. He wants to like subtly help them make their own minds up because, again, if you're rich and powerful and you're like listening to Tucker Carlson, you don't want to be convinced or told what to think. You want to be convinced that you came up with the idea on your own. You want to be the one that feels like you made the decision or you changed your mind.
Let's continue.
One of the things we talked about was Sabbath dinners. Our family congregates every Saturday night in order to inaugurate the Lord's Day, and we are all together in it. Tucker asked me how many of my children and grandchildren were Christians, and by the grace of God, I was able to say, all of them. Everyone is in fellowship, and we gather weekly to pray, sing, and eat together. Now, Tucker told me that his greatest desire was to be the ancestor at the head of such a table, in just this way, with all his people gathered around, sharing table fellowship together. And I believe that Tucker was absolutely sincere in saying that. He is right to want that. It is one of the greatest earthly blessings that I have ever been given, and there's no amount of money that I would accept in exchange for it. But the dank rite is genuinely dank. That road leads to the abyss where there is no table fellowship. And I'm not warning Tucker about his marriage. We were talking about generations. We were talking about your people. Fuente's kids, if he ever manages to have any, are not going to marry and have kids who would be willing to show up for any kind of Norman Rockwell Thanksgiving. If he does not die a lonely incel, the path he is on is far more likely to produce results like this. Two estranged granddaughters, both of whom had their breasts cut off, a grandson with a live-in boyfriend, assorted surly others with Halloween hair, three divorced kids, a cousin who didn't get out of rehab in time to make it, and a couple of dogs that won't stop barking. This is not a prophecy, it is a word painting. So my warning for Tucker is this: there is a generation that have corrupted themselves, perverse and crooked, Deuteronomy 32:5. The Lord looks at them, and he says, I will see what their end shall be, Deuteronomy 32:20. These cautions are taken from the Song of Moses, the solemn warning that he gave to Israel as a testimony against them. It also contains the text for Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon about sinners in the hands of an angry God. Their foot shall slip in due time, Deuteronomy 32:35. They are a nation void of counsel, neither is there any understanding in them. Deuteronomy 32:28. In sum, it is not possible to be as openly disobedient as the dank rite is without that indicating that they are living downwind of the sewage lagoon containing all their real rebellions.
So, once again, he's conflating the dank right, which is a label he's used on Christian new Christian right.
I'm surprised he's still actually using it. I would have thought he dropped that because it never caught on.
It never caught on. And then he's conflating that with groypers, which is a term that's pretty well established. In, again, he's conflating two groups of people into one. And then basically painting all of his, you know, critics as groypers. It's just, it's bad argument. And there's not really a justification for it. And the generation thing, boomers much? The millennials are on a redemption arc. If you, you know, I they're on a redemption arc.
I actually wrote about this, increasing their religiosity. I mean, if anything, boomers are going hard left, and they're just trying to relive the glory days of the hippie movement. And that's why we laugh about the whole No Kings protest being a bunch of boomers, but not take it seriously for the future ramifications. But yeah, the boomers are trending left, and the polling has shown that.
Yeah, and he wants to condemn the other generation, his generation.
And again,
condemning the Zoomers, which, you know, the Zoomers are a bit of a broken generation because of the previous generations that raised them. Let's just be real about that. But there is a lot of hope there. Like, you know, the Zoomer men, there's a lot of hope for them.
I mean, really, the word picture he was painting could probably describe, like, I don't know, John Piper. But someone that ends up gay. It's just like, or all these like various boomers that have like these freaks for grandchildren. Like, he's describing people that are his age, not the Zoomers.
Yeah, and he's assuming that they'll have it worse, which I don't think is necessarily true.
I mean, what's worse? It's browner. Like, is that worse? Like, you're living in India, not America. Is that? I guess that's how it could get worse. You get all those same things, except it's New Delhi, or whatever.
Right. So anyway, I just thought that was a demonstrably unself-aware thing to say, was to criticize being a boomer and to criticize the next generations as being under judgment from God. Like, are you absolutely kidding me? Anyway.
And the transgressive things I'm talking about are not a negative view of Netanyahu, but rather things like lusting after your sister. In short, 2 tons of no bueno. The mortification of soft feminism in the church. So let's bring all this back to what I earlier called the evangelical longhouse, soft feminism within the church. An uncharitable read of Allie Beth's comments, "We need your masculinity and your strength and courage, and we need those things to be harnessed for good," would be to assume that she was talking about opening jars and getting things off the top shelf in the pantry and so on. Harnessed for good could be made to sound as though the ladies are booted, spurred, and ready to ride. The women have decided to host a great banquet that will put everything right in the church, and they need the men to be cooperative so that they might carry the tables. But there's another way to read the appeal. Masculinity is the glad assumption of sacrificial responsibility. Strength and courage are characteristic of men who are able and willing to lead. If men generally were to look past the big sister aspect of Allie Beth's exhortation and really walk away from porn, one of the direct consequences would actually be the formation of a biblical patriarchy. Biblical patriarchy will not be achieved by running Anon accounts to snark at the men who have jobs and families to feed, nor will it be achieved by snarking at Allie Beth. Biblical patriarchy depends upon men being sexually devoted to their wives, forsaking all others. That is why porn must be outlawed, but it must be banished from the lives of Christian men before anything else could ever be done. The reason we have more aspiring Deborahs in the church than is proper is in part because of the ubiquity of porn. When Christian men use porn and their wives don't know, the men are...
That's just cap. That is not why. Not the reason.
I mean, let's just be honest with ourselves. I mean, the conservative politics, and of course the Dems do this too.
Women's sin is somehow men's fault. That's what he said there. Women's sin in trying to usurp, you know, again, you know, if we want to go back to Adam and Eve, you know, what is the curse? You know, that the woman's desire will be to rebel against her husband.
Well, even still, like if you wanted to say, oh, it's Adam's fault. Well, yeah, it's Adam's fault. But it's not just a failure of Adam's leadership that led to the fall. It's also an inversion of his leadership. Instead of Adam being the leader, technically Eve led Adam into sin. And Adam chose to sin despite having indirectly defying God, knowing the full consequences or the full warning. But yeah, I mean, it's not just a failure of leadership. It was an inversion of leadership. And that's why God says, because you listen to the woman, because you listen to her, therefore you're going to have all these curses. So it was an inversion. It was technically, you could argue, feminism, or, and again, all of it was technically egalitarian because they wanted equality with God. But yeah, I mean, if we go back to the, and again, I'll quote from my article on Doug Wilson and the Abigail thing, because again, I cite John Gill's commentary, and regarding Abigail, he says, no doubt she was directed by the Spirit of God to do what she did, and this being an extraordinary case is not to be drawn into an example. Again, you're not a modern Abigail.
One of the other things about Abigail is that there was something of a quasi contract at work there. Like, you could argue that David was running a protection racket on the plantation or whatever. Like, they were providing protection and therefore expecting payment. Now, David's men didn't mistreat any of the servants. They did in fact provide that protection so that, you know, he wouldn't be attacked. But then they expected payment for some, you know, so there's a quasi contract situation going on. And the time for, was it Nabal was the husband?
Yes.
The time for him to have snubbed David and rejected David would have been before
the protection. Yeah,
he gladly accepted, and he didn't say, I don't want your help.
And also, he said, I'll take your help
and then I won't pay you.
No, but also like flaunting.
Yes. So there's a quasi contract situation going on with David and Nabal, but that's completely, it's kind of overlooked because it's not spelled out, but Abigail fulfilled the obligations of her husband who wanted to spurn them. And that's why David was enraged. Because, you know, you might look at David and say he was, you know, just trying to kill someone out of anger, but it's like, there's a little bit more to that anger than, you know, it was out of, he violated a contract type of anger.
I mean, can we also talk about how like the GOP loves its tokens? It loves promoting women. Like, again, we can go into look at the GOP women in Congress and we can point out stripper, whore, like all of them. Like Luna was a stripper. Nancy Mace, absolute prostitute. I mean, just the biggest one in Congress, which is really saying something. MTG had an affair before her congressional run. I mean, just look her up. Marjorie Taylor Greene, tantric sex guru. The New York Post will come up with a lovely article from years ago. And again, she's also divorced. Lauren Boebert, divorced. Like, and, you know, was seen getting into a car with Kid Rock.
But like, they were only there because men were gooners. Like, what?
No.
Are you kidding
me? The boomers loved these.
How about we talk women. About that's true. They his love generation. It. But are his we not generation. Gonna bring up like counterexamples? Like, why is Kay Ivey why do we have complete Karen? You know, why do we have all these COVID Karen?
Oh, whoa. Since we're talking about
not Alabama, only the Democrat Party, but also, you know, Alabama, Kay Ivey,
Katie Britt in Alabama, the senator, who gave that abhorrent rebuttal to the State of the Union in 2024. She has absolutely no talent. She should not be in the U.S. Senate. And she's only there because she's moderately attractive and a woman. And there were doubtless better qualified men that got denied a seat in the U.S. Senate because of her. Because boomer simps like Doug Wilson will platform women above more qualified men. And again, it happens every single election.
There's go back to Wary's Law. Are you familiar with the concept of Wary's Law?
Well, can I throw one more example called Winsome Sears in Virginia, who got her butt handed to her the other day? Because, and again, they put her in there because she's a woman and she's dark of shade. And she sucked on both counts.
Yeah. Because she couldn't outwoman the Democrat, and she didn't have a hood pass to get that NAACP endorsement.
You're going to tell me that they're stepping up because they're a bunch of aspiring Debras? No, these women are being platformed. They're being elevated. They're being systematically elevated into their slots, and they suck at their jobs.
Right. It's a girl boss thing. Like, these are girl bosses. They have career ambitions. It's not about men being gooners, and that's why these women are achieving high ranks in society. It's about they want that. They want to build careers for themselves. So Wary's Law states that a man will not speak out on an issue unless a woman has done it first, and that any woman in
concern, or minority, I think there's
women or minority, okay. Or and then a woman is always like a popular woman in conservative spaces is 100% of the time on a liberal trajectory. Like, that's the two things of Wary's Law. And I gotta say, I'm not seeing any exceptions to this rule. I'm not. Ali Stuckey, I think, is not an exception to that rule at the moment, because now she's going into female preaching.
Megan Basham was literally defending Spencer Clavin, like,
and Andrew 2 months ago. Like, those are both horrible people who have no place on the right, who should not be allowed to, who should not be employed in conservative ink. The Daily Wire and the Claremont Institution or Institute, respectively, just to name names of people employing those people. They should not be employed. Like, Spencer Clavin should not be allowed to be, should not be employed by, Claremont Institute. Like, that's a disgrace. So, but, and, you know, that's been defended. So I'll have a disagreement with Megan Basham on that, but, and I'm hoping that that's not a trajectory and that's just a one-off, but,
you know. Again, women like Riley Gaines exist, even though there are probably better qualified men who could be getting a lot of her speaking
slots. Because, well, again, Who actually showed courage? Kyle Rittenhouse or Riley Gaines? Kyle Rittenhouse did, because there Daniel was a Penny. Window of opportunity for courage. He went into the gap to help people, and then, you know, they tried this. They threw the book at him for a slam dunk self-defense case. They threw the book at him for that. All right, let's finish up, Doug. I don't think there's that much left to finish up. We'll see.
They're reluctant to take the initiative and lead because they know they are not qualified to do so. And when their women do know about the problem, the men are in the doghouse and are in no position to be spiritually assertive. And to add another layer of weirdness to it, there are women who on some level like the fact that their husbands struggle with porn because they appreciate the leverage that the doghouse gives to them. Sure, they don't like it in one way, finding it distasteful and all, but if the husband ever got real victory over that sin and began leading his family as he ought to, she might find that she likes that setup even less. This is because in the creation order, women were created to be responsive to their husbands, Ephesians 5:22. That desire is in their marrow. But because of the fall, the Lord God ordained that a certain level of leadership tension will always exist between husband and wife, Genesis 3:16. This can create some interesting churn in a woman's heart, where she despises a man she can dominate and at the same time likes getting her way. So we should really be interested in getting rid of 56 wannabe Deborahs. And you might even think that Alibeth is one of them. I don't care. But we are not going to get rid of any of them until we come to realize the value of the point she was making. Don't.
Again, I just disagree with that in general. Let's finish up the clip, though.
Ever neglect the giveaways.
Okay.
There are two places to go for your giveaways. The first is the special page that Canon set up to process.
Okay. That was the end. Okay. Man, he made it seem like his advertisement was, like a conclusion to his article. I do want to say I do agree with the part at the end where he talked about women would use a man conquering his sin as, they would revile that. The reviling wife concept. Hopefully we'll get David Edgington on to discuss that concept more. Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, that is the plot of Fireproof, where the guy conquers his sin and his wife hates him more for it begrudgingly, until he finally wins her over. Kirk Cameron, who's apparently not a Zionist. So good job.
Yeah, that was brave.
You've seen Fireproof. You've seen Fireproof. Good job, man. Yeah, and I think that point was right. If a man does actually do this, if a man is doing the right thing, his wife actually might hate him, hate it because it, removes her leverage and perceived victimhood status. So I thought that was a good point. But here's the thing. Men are getting browbeated as though they're stuck in this sin, this specific sin of pornography. And then, men need actionable steps. Like, okay, what do we do now? We've stopped doing this. What do we do now? And all people like Doug Wilson are saying is stop looking at porn. Stop masturbating. Stop, cancel your OnlyFans account and all that other stuff. They're just getting told the same instruction over and over and over again. And when they object to that instruction, they're being told they must have the problem. And I got to say, it's like, what is the pathway? Do these people only have so limited a pathway of instruction for men? And I guess that might be the issue moving forward. Like, what is the more constructive path that Doug Wilson should be providing? The guy's a grandfather. He has a very grandfatherly tone and presentation. And I happen to know that there's a lot of people he would call the dank right in his own church. And he's not necessarily clamping down on those people. So what is the instruction he's given those people that they would stay in his church? And how about he provide some of that instead of the bulverism, as you put it? That's a bigger word than I'm used to.
It's a C.S. Lewis word.
I know.
Which is funny because, again, I learned, you learn about it on like Wade Stott. Literally does a video. He works for Canon.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's the most talented person in the Canon Press like network other than Doug Wilson. Like, he would be the next Doug Wilson, except he's not a pastor. Or maybe Chocolate Knox. I don't know if he's a pastor, though, or he's just really good with theology. But it's definitely not Toby Sumter. It's definitely not Gabe Wrench. Just saying. So I'll do a last call for questions because we don't need to do this very long tonight. But otherwise, if you like this kind of content, do also subscribe to the channel, to the podcast, if you are new. I don't think we have too much time to address other topics because I kind of, I don't want to do as long of live streams as we used to more consistently do back in the day. But anyway, I will say this, the whole Conservative Inc. thing, is Israel First versus MAGA America First. It definitely became obvious today that, this is just a proxy for the soul of J.D. Vance. So it's kind of interesting because I think J.D. Vance has the 2028 primary in the bag if he wants
it. Yes, and you're going to see them fight over J.D. Vance. You're going to have like almost three factions. You're going to have the people.
That, I'd love to see them take a shot at the Prince and miss.
I mean, you're going to see the James Lindsay crowd, which hates J.D. Vance. They've already kind of expressed it. You're going to see the Joel Berry crowd that you know, wants to co-opt J.D. Vance and say, oh, he's one of me. He's just like me, believes everything I believe. And then you're maybe going to see the crowd that wants to back J.D. Vance, but also wants to knife him in the back. And they want to actually, like, be on his side, but at the same time sabotage him. So you're gonna see multiple dynamics play out.
Okay. Getting confirmation that Chocolate Knox is not a pastor or elder. And again, maybe that's why he's more based.
Yeah, I mean, pastors.
Something about an MDiv, I think, just
makes horrible people at politics.
Yes, there's something about that. I don't know why, but
it's because you conflate really politics and theology, and you think just because you read a theology textbook means you understand politics. But you know, that wasn't a theology textbook written by John Calvin or Francis Chariton, but you know, published in the last 100 years or 50 years, if we're going to be more blunt.
So, all right. I don't see any, at least no recent questions.
Check out the article on the Heritage Foundation, and Driscoll also talks a little bit to the gamer issue and the millennial.
I'm gonna hope to get a guest on to talk about the gamer issue, just because I think, there's a connection with. You know, there's obviously people that suck at video games and think that Fortnite is real gaming and stuff, that, you know, they go to Fortnite to goon pipeline. But there's also people that take gaming and storytelling and games seriously that, you know, are very based and, you know, Christian Halo to Christianity pipeline. You know what I'm saying? So that might be a worthy discussion if I can find a good guest for that, because I'm not enough of a gamer that I would know that. Like, I, you know, play video games occasionally, like last night or whatever. Well, but
the thesis was that Gamergate led to the Bro Revival. So that's a very interesting argument. I did have to crowdsource some my arguments just to make sure that they held up to, I guess, scrutiny, or that they matched the facts. So,
yeah. And, you know, I might also say something along the lines that Halo is actually more Christian than Lord of the Rings. But, you know, first five games specifically. So anyway, I play a few hours a week. It's over for me. Yes. Yes, it is. Apparently, according to Driscoll. So anyway, I think that's all we got for tonight. My name is Ray. This is Anthony. If you like this content, do also subscribe to the channel, the podcast. If you're new, we also have a free free newsletter. And then we have a paid Patreon-like system at the evangelicaldarkweb.org/join. Linked in the description below. Also have a book, Winning Not Winsome, 10 Commandments of Spiritual Warfare. And that's it. Have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
Are we exposed? Security teams ask this every day. Vulnerabilities across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos hide the truth, and attackers are watching. Tenable unifies your tools, teams, and data so you can spot and close risks fast. Tenable's AI-powered exposure management gives teams one view of risk, helping them focus, take action, and close critical exposures fast. Visit Tenable.com. Tenable. Your exposure ends here.